Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Tuesday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, I'll be speaking to Professor Kingston Mills about a warning that faulty facts on social media are resulting in some parents electing to delay getting their children vaccinated. I'll be talking to Francis Byrne of Early Childhood Ireland on that organisation's opinion that the government needs to prioritise childcare after a decade of underfunding. We'll be speaking to Seamus Clancy of Repack on the fact its Plastic Pledge members have reduced plastic packaging waste by almost a fifth last year. And we'll also hear from Adam Shanley. He's Empower Programme Manager at HIV Ireland. And Kildare, Dublin and Wicklow account for 79% of all new cases of syphilis reported this year. That's according to the Health Protection Surveillance Centre. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email if you wish, studio@kfmradio.com, and you can always tweet us at KFM Radio.
All the hits, all day. KFM!
A group of medical and scientific experts from the Royal Irish Academy have said that some parents are delaying getting their children vaccinated because of what the RIA describes as faulty facts on social media. I'm joined on the line now by one of two people who have written a 14-page paper on vaccines to debunk misinformation, and that is Professor Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Kingston, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I suppose there has been vaccine scepticism really since that very long and very roundly debunked non-peer-reviewed paper appeared linking erroneously MMR to autism. Why is it so difficult to remove that particular fact and all that has stemmed from it from the public consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, that was a setback for the whole vaccine, the whole benefits of vaccination, and the uptake of MMR vaccines went down around the time, and then there were subsequent issues around the human papillomavirus vaccine, the HPV vaccine, which is against cervical cancer, that were, you know, doing the rounds of social media, and uptake of the HPV vaccine in Ireland dropped, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, to 55%, and that's not enough if you want to protect people that die from cervical cancer. And then a campaign which was launched by various groups, including a woman that was suffering from cervical cancer. She had a very strong voice in persuading people of the benefits of the vaccination. That sort of turned it around. And our position paper really is to inform the public of the benefits, but also the risks. And it's important to say that not every vaccine or not every medicine is completely devoid of side effects, but it's about balancing the benefit versus the risk.
And also, I would imagine, informing people of how they can critically assess these so-called faulty facts and discern fact from fiction in the sphere of vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, as scientists, we're always trained to read the scientific literature, and there's a very tried and tested method that scientists use. There's one website called PubMed, which is run by the National Institute of Health in the US, where all the published articles of biomedical science are accessible. So if it's a peer-reviewed article, that's the critical point. Peer-reviewed means it will have been assessed by experts before it's allowed to be published. It will be listed on this website. So that's our sort of go-to source of information. Stuff that appears on websites that's uncorroborated, scientists take with a pinch of salt. And, you know, unfortunately, those websites, especially social media, transmission of information from those websites tends to be based not necessarily on scientific rigor, and it's hearsay. So someone says that, oh, this is connected with that, without providing evidence to back it up, and that's the big problem. And then people start believing that, and it gets legs. So it's a matter of, you know, the public just being cautious about where they get the information from and making sure they're getting it from a reliable source.
And talk us through some of the points in your paper on vaccines that you have released, Kingston, along with Bert Rima, specifically to kind of try to alleviate this misinformation problem.
Yeah. Dick Ulstrom, the former journalist of the Irish Times, was also a co-author, and he contributed to it as well. So really, it's about explaining to people what vaccines are, how they work, how they're made, but also the huge benefit, but also going into some of the side effects. There are risks, and we're not saying that no vaccine is without risks. Every medicine has a certain level of risk, but it's really about balancing that risk versus the benefit, and that's the key take-home message from this. COVID-19, for example, is a very serious disease in older people, but even in younger people, it can leave long-lasting effects known as long COVID. That can persist for up to a year, even in younger people. So that's the risk of getting the disease versus the risk of the vaccine. And there are risks. I mean, a lot of people would get mild sore arm after the injection. Some might get a fever, headaches. And then there were, of course, the clotting events associated with the adenovirus vector vaccines, which are, between 1 in 100,000 and 1 in a million. So they're not common, but they do occur. But again, you have to balance that risk versus the risk of getting COVID and the consequences of that. And that's why it is all about the benefit over the possible risk.
And I think an awful lot of people, when they hear the word risk, may be so risk averse, quite understandably, in terms of health decisions for themselves or for their children, and indeed the parental psychology in particular is very risk sensitive, absolutely appropriately. But when they hear the word risk, their immediate instinctive reaction is no, rather than trying to understand that risk is on a spectrum of experience and isn't a certainty.
Yeah, I mean, if you could use the analogy of the risk of an airline flight or a risk of driving your car with your children to school. We know that traffic accidents occur. It's a risk you take every day you step into a car, and every time you take an airline flight, there's a risk that something will happen. But you calculate that risk and you say to yourself, well, the chances are 1 in 2 million that the plane is going to go down or that I'm going to have a collision that is going to result in a serious injury when you drive your car. It's the same with taking a vaccine. You've got to adjust the risk, and nothing you do has no risk. So it's very, very important that you balance those. And that's, again, the important take-home message here. You have to look at, in particular in relation to something like cervical cancer. Cervical cancer kills several hundred, or used to kill 700 women in Ireland every year. It's a very serious cancer, which will kill women in a lot of cases that get it, and men. Men can get human papillomavirus and get penile cancer and oral cancers. And there's a vaccine that is 95% effective at preventing that. The risks associated with that vaccine are tiny. It's a really safe and extremely effective vaccine, and it really has had dramatic effects in reducing the incidence of cervical cancers and other related cancers. So that's a huge benefit there. And if you look at other diseases like smallpox, eliminated from the globe, poliovirus, which killed a lot of people in the 20s and 30s, it's now eliminated from every country in the world apart from two, thanks to vaccination. Other things like diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, haemophilus, meningococcus, all of these diseases that were major problems in young children are not a thing of the past, but they're very close to, most of them are being close to being at a very, very low incidence. So that's all a direct result of vaccination.
And Kingston, is your paper published? Can people access it?
Yes, it's on the, so if you go into the Royal Irish Academy and put in vaccine statement in Google, you'll find it. So it's there, readily accessible for the public, and it's written in a reasonable lay language. We were aware that it was designed for it to be accessible to the public as well as to scientists, and that's why Dick Ulstrom was very helpful in doing that, and that he was a journalist who was familiar with writing for the public, so he helped to keep it, it helped us make sure that we were making it accessible.
Well, Professor Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology, Trinity College Dublin, speaking to us on that paper, co-written, of course, by former Irish Times journalist Dick Ulstrom and Bert Rima, an emeritus professor at Queen's University.
Want to get in touch with your favourite show on KFM? Text or WhatsApp us now on 0833 97 97 97.
The Director of Policy at Early Childhood Ireland, writing an opinion piece, tells us that the government needs to prioritise childcare after a decade of underfunding. I'm joined on the line now by that very Director of Policy at Early Childhood Ireland, Frances Byrne. Frances, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks so much, Ciara.
I note that ECI has also released its pre-budget submission today, and it kind of underscores your viewpoint of that decade of underfunding. If €970 million was required in expenditure and supports over the next 7 years.
Yes, it's a government commitment made by the previous government, and the current one has said that it will honour the commitment, which is in a document called First Five, which is Ireland's first national early year strategy. And in there, the government has committed to double funding, and you're quite right, it would bring it up to €970 million by 2028. So we expected, given that last year in October the government announced the 2021 budget, we fully expected to hear an increase and to hear a plan, and we didn't. Mm. So this year we are saying to government, and we've written to every member of bureaucracy today, but we began with the Minister for Children, whom we also met recently, and we have said budget 2022 has to be the moment when the government starts to honour the commitment and tells us how they're going to get there by 2028.
Because I would imagine your members all over the country, Frances, are telling you essentially the same story. I know that in or around 13 childcare providers in Kildare closed last year, shut their doors completely. And there's constant competition and waiting lists for places at creches all over this county. Parents say that, you know, the costs are going through the roof, yet providers are saying we're stuck between a rock and a hard place here. We have to meet standards. We have to pay staff. Staff, in some instances, are leaving the industry because they feel that they're underpaid for the skills that they require. So it's nearly a perfect storm. Had you tried to design a crisis, you'd be hard-pressed in a childcare context, you'd be hard-pressed to make one more dramatic than this.
I'm afraid that I'm so sad to acknowledge it, but that's absolutely true. We have what we call, in a very serious way, and I'm not using flippant language deliberately, but we have a triple whammy, exactly as you have described. And what that means on a day-to-day basis is that we have very low pay. We have high standards and we have, you know, good regulations. We have a very good curriculum. We have 30,000 brilliant educators, some of whom are educated to master's level. There's research that shows even getting a degree will only improve pay by €1 an hour. So we know that. The government knows all of that, and that's why they've made this commitment. And in the same document, they've committed to getting us to a graduate-led workforce. In other words, predominantly, we will see a workforce that has university.
Frances, just move around a small little bit. Your line is falling out there.
Is this okay here?
Yeah, it's a smidge better, yeah.
Okay. And hopefully...
No, I think we're going to have to come back to Frances Owen. If you could see if we can re-get Frances on that. It's a really important topic, and we want to ensure that we can stay with it. On to matters slightly different, and I know that an awful lot of you will have heard our continued reportage of housing developments granted here in Kildare as a result of the strategic housing planning mechanism, which enabled developers to bypass Kildare County Council perfectly legitimately if they had plans to build 100 or more homes. And it's been controversial because an awful lot of the strategic housing development projects that were approved by a board, Planola, were thereafter appealed to the courts. So the Cabinet has today backed plans to scrap and replace strategic housing planning arrangements. The Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, says new streamlined arrangements for large-scale residential developments will be introduced. It's expected the new system will come into being in the autumn. The current process was dogged by legal challenges and lengthy delays. As always, do remember, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
We've rattled the gremlins out of the system, and Frances Byrne, Director of Policy of Early Childhood Ireland, joins us yet again. Frances, you're welcome back to us.
Thank you so much.
We've actually just gotten a WhatsApp in from Michelle, which I think really typifies the point that Early Childhood Ireland is making, and it is this budget projection going to provide for the workers as well as the children? We have high standards, Frances, as you have already noted, and high qualifications. Creche places are expensive, but I still only earn €11 an hour in a job I'm doing for 14 years. I'm on the 8-week summer break now, where I have to sign on for social welfare and receive €89 a week. Michelle's story, and thank you for sharing that with us, Michelle, has to be replicated right across the country in almost every childcare setting.
Yes, approximately 10% of educators like Michelle, so about 3,000 or so, have to go on the dole every summer because of the way our current system is set up. So to answer the question in a very clear way, yes, we would absolutely wanting and wishing, and we've told the Minister this, for staff wages to be prioritised. You know, people like Michelle, 98% of educators in the sector are women. So if I may say, women like Michelle are working so hard. When we or anyone else puts on courses, they're usually at night because people are working during the day. Michelle and her colleagues come in their thousands, same with the weekends. There's no doubt about people's commitment and their professionalism. So it would be our number one priority. And we met the Minister 2 weeks ago about our budget, and we absolutely talked about the workforce with him and urged him to prioritise. And I must say and put on the record, the Minister has set up, well, he has taken the baton from his predecessor. So Minister O'Gorman has set up two processes, one looking at funding and one looking at workforce. Early Childhood Ireland is involved in both. And certainly the workforce is front and centre in terms of policy. So it really needs to happen for educators like Michelle and others.
I mean, there's more reports, Frances, on the childcare sector and others sitting on shelves in government buildings and elsewhere than you and I have had hot dinners. Do you have any confidence that either of these two streams of investigation or your meetings with Minister Roderick O'Gorman will bear fruit for women like Michelle?
We're hopeful. I think that one of the reasons, the main reason why we were so shocked when this year's budget was announced last October, when childcare was barely a footnote in one of the ministerial speeches, because we have all seen, even if we don't have children in creches, we have seen childcare become a de facto essential public service. The government has provided dedicated funding for the sector in acknowledgement of the pressure the sector is under. We have seen, Early Childhood Ireland has seen, and we're very proud that our members reopened at the end of June last year. Most of them have remained open. They've implemented very stringent public health guidance. They've implemented a wage subsidy scheme, as I said, and they've kept the show on the road. So, you know, you're absolutely right. There are myriad reports, but there are also myriad countries where we know this works. It's not rocket science. We can make this work. We need political ambition, though. And that's what we're, if you allow me to say it this way, we're putting that up to the government and saying, look, we're shining a spotlight on a commitment you've already made. Please honour that promise to children. Families have waited way too long for this to happen, so that they can enjoy certainty. And absolutely, the 30,000 educators like Michelle and others absolutely are deserving of proper terms and conditions. They do a job that is akin to teaching. They do a job that requires professional qualifications, constant updating of skills and so on. They have their, you know, they're looking after our most precious citizens. So for all of those reasons, it's time to move Ireland into the top of the league. At the moment, despite increased funding from the last government, Ireland is languishing at the bottom of the OECD public investment table. We really have to see Budget 2022 change that.
Frances Byrne, Director of Policy at Early Childhood Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. REPAC members' plastic pledge signatories really made extraordinary strides last year, despite the pandemic, to reduce the volume of plastic packaging used in their products. To tell us about it, I'm joined on the line by CEO of REPAC, Seamus Clancy. Seamus, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Nice to talk to you too.
We're delighted to have you. A reduction in plastic packaging waste by 18.6%. By any measure, that's significant.
Well, it is very significant. That's 23,000 tonnes, and that's over 135 signatories of the Plastic Pledge in Ireland, and those 135 represent about 80% of all plastic placed on the market, and across about 200 projects. But it's not an immediate action that happened last year. We started this in 2018. We set out a strategy for Ireland for 2018-2030, and the Plastic Pledge was a very, very important component of that. And I suppose it's like anything in life, Ciara. If it isn't measured, it doesn't become important.
Mm.
And that's why the Plastic Pledge is so important, because it has five very key objectives, of which everybody who signed up to the Plastic Pledge has to be measured against. The first one, I suppose, objective is to prioritise the prevention of plastic packaging waste. And you'll find it interesting, you're going to your supermarkets tomorrow, and you remember the children's drinks with the straws in them.
Very fiddly straws, but yes.
Well, they are now gone. They were banned since the 3rd of July. But many of people who signed up to the Plastic Pledge have already done so. So in total, about 50 million units have already been impacted. So you won't find those in your shelves anymore. The other second big objective is to reduce the complexity in plastic packaging. As you're aware, like, the consumer is always very confused about what you can recycle and what you can't. So what we're seeing is a major move towards the use of single polymers, as in plastic packaging, that can actually be recycled. And that is actually really positive. We're seeing one particular manufacturer has moved away. For instance, polystyrene is no longer included.
Does that mean, Seamus, that for products that are manufactured in Ireland, we might at some point arrive at the stage where on the packaging, the little label that says, can you recycle it? It'll just say yes or no.
Yes, we're coming to that. We're waiting as part of the Single-Use Plastics Directive and the Circular Economy Package for guidance from Europe. So there's a commonality of labelling right across the European Union and in Ireland in particular as well. And we're getting there. It's taking time because there is a lot of complexity around plastic. But you're going to see it made easier for the consumer later in the year as well, when there'll be significant changes in what can go into your recycling bin and what can't. And that's something will be announced in September. But there are three other really big objectives as well as part of the Plastic Pledge. It means that anybody who signs up to this as well must assist in hitting the recycling targets as set out by the European Union. It has to also make sure that the recycling content of packaging placed on the market is brought to 30% by 2030. Some of those already from the Plastic Pledge, you'll see they're well ahead on that.
Mm.
So, but it's something. But more important, the last thing then, I suppose, that the priority of the objective is to make sure it doesn't impact food waste, and to improve food waste. And everybody has to sign up to the EPA's Food Waste Charter, because if you think about it, we generate roughly 3 million tons of waste as householders per annum. About 1 million tons of that goes to incineration, 1 million tons of that is packaging, and 1 million tons almost is food waste.
Which is a staggering amount of food.
Absolutely. So the whole idea here as part of the Plastic Pledge is that the expertise that we have in Repack is getting the producers to focus on doing the right thing and to measure it. And as part of that, we've also deliver on design guides for packaging right across the consumer chain or the producer chain, but to make sure that, those packaging are also made easy for the consumer to understand. So it's really saying to business, look, you really need to take the whole issue of packaging seriously. It can no longer be driven by the marketeers and business just to make it something that's very attractive for the consumer, but you also have to take into account the recycling systems and what you can do to, you know, prevent, minimise and recycle as much as possible. So from that perspective, it's very welcome, but there's a lot more to do, Ciara. We need a lot more businesses to buy into this, And a lot of the lowest hanging fruit is for business to do a lot more and make it easy for the consumer to do their job.
And Seamus, tell us a little about the signatories that have already signed up to the Plastic Pledge in terms of the kinds of business they're engaged in, because I would imagine it might be easier for some kind of, for some producers than others, to pivot to reducing plastic content in their packaging, dependent upon the type of product they produce.
You're on the money, Ciara. That is very much the case. You take, for instance, the beverage industry, be it carbonated or non-carbonated drinks. Nearly every one of the producers in that area are aiming to have at least 50% of the recycled content in place by 2030, and some are even going to hit that by 2025. So when you look at, say, some of the big brands on your shelves today, there's already a significant recycling content in those bottles. So it isn't as if plastic is bad, far from it. Plastic is actually a really, really good product that actually makes it easier to make sure we have safe food on our shelves. So some of the big manufacturers are already there on that. I can't mention them by name.
No, I understand.
Yeah, whereas then you take, for instance, the... I mentioned about the drinks earlier on, but you take then some, I'll say the big retailers in this country are very focused now on reducing the and segregating the plastic that's generated in their stores. That's moved to another level. Some have managed to nearly do 90% recycling of everything that's produced in their stores. And that just shows that the decision-making in business as well, it's moved from the back door of business right up the chain to the actual board table, where sustainability is now becoming a priority, and rightly so, and not before time.
Well, Seamus Clancy, Chief Executive of Repack, thank you indeed for joining us to share with us the 2020 Repack Members Plastic Pledge Report. Now, the Health Protection Surveillance Centre has warned of a nationwide outbreak of syphilis, which seems to be particularly prevalent in Kildare, Dublin and Wicklow. 79% of all cases reported in the first 4 months of this year of syphilis were in one of those three counties. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Adam Shanley. He's Empower Programme Manager at HIV Ireland. Adam, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hiya, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. I just want to pick up on one point that the HSPC has made, which I think would apply to all forms of sexual health and sexually transmitted infection. And it says there's a potentially large undiagnosed reservoir. It's referring specifically to syphilis in this instance. But I would imagine a lot of people either have not engaged in sexual health testing or have put it off because of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's definitely been much more difficult in recent times to be able to access testing for sexual health, for STIs. So, and like you say, yeah, it could be coupled as well with not only access being an issue, but perhaps putting it off too. So yeah, it's been a tricky time, and that's part of the reason I think why STIs are on the rise at the moment.
And I mean, 79%, or certainly a surge of increase of reported infections, the order of which the HSPC is advising of us, of any STI, is deeply worrying. But syphilis isn't the first thing that springs to mind when you think of sexually transmitted disease or infection. You're more likely to think perhaps of herpes, of chlamydia, of gonorrhea, of HIV. It's not an infection we hear of that often.
Yeah, the other STIs are definitely a lot more common, or they're commonly known or heard of. And actually, you know, syphilis is really having quite a comeback. There were periods in the past where syphilis was nearly eradicated. But unfortunately, it is making a comeback. And as you say, it's really kind of disproportionately affecting people in the east of the country at the moment here in Ireland, in Kildare, Dublin and Wicklow.
Do we know why that is? Because I suppose it could be as easily be that the people in the east of the country have readier access to testing facilities.
Yeah, I think there's a whole host of different reasons as to why there's the kind of increase. I mean, COVID has really impacted every aspect of the nation's health, either directly or indirectly, but it has had a considerable impact on the availability of sexual health testing. and treatment services across the country. So when people can't access testing, we're slow to diagnose and treat these infections, and they're then transmitted unknowingly at much higher rates, much like what we've all learned from COVID. You know, quick access to testing and treatment is key. And the cyber attack, I think, as well, has had on the HSC system, that's also had a considerable impact on disease surveillance. I suppose being armed with the data is crucial to understanding how to respond, and that's been interrupted because of the hack too. But there's a considerable amount of effort being put into it now in terms of an outbreak control team that's being gathered to look at what the data that we have, and to look at how we can increase opportunities to for people to access testing and to get treated for syphilis, so that we can kind of stem onward transmission and kind of put syphilis back in its box, I suppose.
I suppose that the key thing to stemming an outbreak is to hope that there isn't one in the first instance, so that would be to engage in safe sex.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the tricky things about syphilis is that it's a very, very transmissible bacterial infection. So it's acquired through all types of sex, including oral sex. And while condoms offer very good protection against syphilis, as I say, it's very, very transmissible. So close skin contact with the syphilis bacteria can lead to infection. However, although it's very easy to get, thankfully it's very easy to cure too, particularly when diagnosed early. So accessing testing really is quite important, because left untreated, syphilis can lead to some very serious health complications. So I definitely say to your listeners, if you're sexually active, particularly if you have multiple partners, accessing regular testing really is key.
And as you say, Adam, it doesn't necessarily require penetrative sex in order to transmit syphilis. If it can effectively, and I'm using this term very advisedly, jump, not necessarily, across canyons from one person to another, but if any kind of physical contact can lead to transmission of that bacteria, it might be reasonable for people to assume that they don't have it, when in fact they may have been at risk and not known.
Absolutely. I think, you know, because, you know, syphilis is a bit of one of those tricky kind of infections. So like I say, you've rightly pointed out, it being very infectious, different types of sex or close contact could allow for it to be transmitted. But while syphilis kind of comes with a range of symptoms, not everyone who has syphilis experiences them. And so that's why a lot of people at the moment may have syphilis and not know about it. And often if symptoms do appear, they can be in parts of the body that you might not notice. So, for example, you know, in the vagina or in the anus or in the throat. So symptoms aren't always a reliable way to know if you've got syphilis. So, again, really, testing is your only bet.
And Adam, I would imagine there are people listening to us going, look, I want to get tested, I just don't know how to go about it, and I do not want to go through the family GP.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, there are a range of ways. So I think, first of all, you know, if I'd strongly suggest that anyone who suspects they may have syphilis to get in touch with their local sexual health service. You can attend your GP, but if you didn't want to go to your GP, reach out to your local sexual health service. In general, if you're sexually active and haven't been tested for syphilis before or in some time, you can access clinics, but I'd also recommend accessing the HSE online testing service, which they've actually recently made available to residents of Kildare. You can go to sh24.ie, you put in your details there, and they'll send you a test for all STIs, including syphilis, in the post, and it's in discreet packaging, so nobody will know what you're receiving. And you send the samples back, and you receive your results by text, or if something is positive, then they'll call you to arrange treatments, which is also free. So that's a really kind of a low threshold, very easy way to get tested and treated if you need it. And as I say, it's completely free and discreet as well.
Just remind us of that website address, Adam.
That's sh24.ie.
That is brilliant. Thank you so much. Adam Shanley, Empower Programme Manager at HIV Ireland. Thank you indeed for joining us. And that website again, sh24.ie. My thanks to you all for your company as ever this afternoon. My thanks to Kildare Focus producer this week, Owen Beattie. Don't forget that Ger McNally will bring you live coverage of Kildare under 20 hurlers in quarterfinal action this evening. Throw in there is at 7:30 and he will join you for a preview a little before that. Paul Power is up after the news at 3. He'll bring you an hour of Classic Gold, followed then by at 4:00 with K-Drive. You can also hear a reprise of Kildare Today and Kildare Focus from 10:30 tonight.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.